the game of light. We were looking at in the board game workshop earlier. That's got choices attached to it. Not very broad or interesting choices, but you know, occasionally the board has forks, and you choose one fork or the other. But even though you're making choices, you're in a game that is all about conforming to social norms, and not very broad choices. When you get into more complicated games, you can find interesting emergent properties of their rule set. Diplomacy is a very simple and elegant set of rules, but they are so carefully balanced, the forces of that game world are so carefully balanced against each other that betrayal and treachery are implicit in them, because that's the only way you can actually win. Simple strategy will never win you in diplomacy. On to video games, Bruce Sterling wrote a book many years back by now, called Islands in the Net, that had one of the incidents in it. The protagonist is, for various reasons, trapped in a Cold War era submarine. Book set in the future, but you know, an old fashioned submarine. And one of the things that is on it that was originally there to help the sailors pass the time was some 80s era video games. And the protagonist is kind of startled by them. It's a little quote here. One game was called Missile Command. The player controlled little lumps on the screen meant to represent cities. The computer attacked them. Nuclear weaponry, bombs, jets, ballistic missiles. The machine always won, annihilating all life in a big flashy display. Children had once played this game. It was utterly morbid. Then there was one called Space Invaders. The invading creatures were little pixel crabs and devil dogs, the UFO things from another planet, dehumanized figures, marching down the screen in lockstep. They always won. You could slaughter them by the hundreds, even win new little forts to fire things. Lasers? Bombers? But you always died in the end. The computer always won. It made so little sense, letting the computer win every time, as if circuitry could enjoy winning. And every effort, no matter how heroic, ended in Armageddon. It was also eldritch, so 20th century. There was a third game that involved a kind of round, yellow consumer. The object was to eat everything in sight, including, sometimes, the little blue pursuing enemies. And the character's fast, I think. Of course, he's missing one of the vital structural reasons for why these games have the philosophy that they do have, which is that all three of those games are fundamentally extremely capitalist at the root. And Pac-Man expresses it in the actual gameplay a little explicitly, but all of them do in the sense that they're all designed to get you to put in another quarter. Something that today is not, most game designers are not concerned with.
So to some extent, we still are. Those of us in the MMO industry, it's not another quarter, it's another $15 at the end of the month that we want you to pay to get another life.
Yes, but you don't, significantly, you don't do that by making the player fail.
Never win.
Yeah.
We make it so that you can never win. It's not that we make you lose, it's that we make you never win.
Uh-huh.
So there's always more game in front of you.
The mention of the big flashy destruction of Missile Command naturally brings to mind another computer game of that era, Chris Crawford's Balance of Power, which was a Cold War political simulator. And if in that game you got to a lose condition and nuclear war breaks out, a screen of bare text comes up saying, I'm not giving you a big flashy nuclear explosion graphic because I don't want to reward this kind of failure. That was a very political statement.
Has anyone here played Civilization Revolution? You guys launched a new game yet?
No, I don't want to do my bullshit.
Nothing happens.
Like, you blow up the city, but they're not going to be getting repercussions for you. Like, as long as you're not a democracy, because they won't let you do it.
Right.
But, you know, the other thing in that game is that you can, through the mechanics, you can change governments, like, literally every turn. But you can launch a nuclear missile, and there's no repercussions on you.
When it's a revolution play?
It's
a four?
Not exactly.
No. It's totally reversed.
It looks like it's four consoles is what it is.
No, that's true.
The control scheme and the gameplay are seriously modified from
the game. The games only take like 3 hours.
And of course, now I was going to bring up Civ because the original Civilization is one of the early examples of explicitly through game design working in a subtle ideology, because in most iterations of Civ, nuclear weapons, while they are big and flashy, are strategically suck. They cause massive amounts of pollution, everybody in the world hates you, and they're only of limited military effectiveness. And that was all done through game design balance. In order to specifically make players, the designer's goal was to make players not think of nuclear war as a good idea.
I wonder if that reflects a change in Sid Meier's values then. Because in this game, like, if you're at war with a culture and you launch nuclear weapon on their hometown, they're like, all right, we're at peace now. Like,
it's a peace bomb.
I don't have anything to retaliate
with. I've never gotten to the point in the game where they've also had a nuclear weapon.
Interestingly, in Civ 3, I did play a game where tech was being traded around so fast that several of the other Civs had nuclear weapons, and one entire continent ended up blanketed in pollution because there did two major Civs on it that both got nukes, and every city on the continent had been nuked multiple times because they had gone into some sort of mode where all they built was nukes.
And of course, that continent essentially was
like, that continent was gone. Nobody's ever going back there.
Is there another global repercussions for that?
Yeah, there's some sort of global warming thing
In most cities, nukes cause pollution. Pollution causes global warming. So launching more than like a nuke will send it to someone else with those CRs.
Yeah. And similarly, at least in the very early Civ games, they took this even further in that we think nuclear power is bad too. You can build a nuclear power plant, but it's only a little bit more efficient than the other power plants, and it has a disastrous failure mode built in that there is no defense against, that you know, that makes it a clearly wrong choice from an imaginary perspective. And if you tried using one, you'd soon stop.
I wonder how much of that is just a reflection of kind of pop culture sensibilities, or just a social belief more so than the designers specifically influencing the kids.
I mean, for in particular, it felt very much like the designers had said, we are going to teach you some ideology.
So?
Yeah, a lot of the text of the technologies and a lot of the effects of some of the governmental styles made very clear that they thought certain styles of government were better and that certain avenues of technology were better.
I thought they were trying pretty hard to gain balance, especially the way they handled religion. A lot of religions are identically symmetrical.
The religions were identically symmetrical, and I did appreciate that.
I mean, I think it might have been more interesting if they weren't. I can see why they did that.
I haven't played this for that much, but I remember reading that polytheism is fundamentally less advanced than monotheism.
Yeah, that's been the case.
Yes.
In Civ Red, if you're a democracy, you can't start a war. You cannot do it. You cannot.
How the hell is that
true? You know what I'm saying? That's the upside of democracy in games, that you need double silence and double money.
you cannot start over. You cannot attack another nature. You can defend yourself. Well, you defend yourself, but yeah, you can't.
You can totally send units into someone else's territory and wait for them to hit you.
Because as soon as you step into someone else's territory in this game, it's like an actual war. But so that's.
So there are some messages that. You know, they were trying to put in explicitly. But there are other messages in the game that are just there that they did not intend. And in some of the later versions that they took out. The first couple civilization games reward small cities more than big cities. Many small cities is much more efficient than few large cities. And that wasn't something that they particularly intended. But in fact, the ultimate, you know, cheese strategy for winning Civ 1 is carpet the continent with size 1 cities. And Civ also has a pretty significant message about how much your starting position in life matters. The geography of the game, where you start in the world, has a vast, vast influence over how your game is going to go. And you can be hosed from the start, or you can have an awesome game from the start.
Both in terms of terrain and attraction.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not the Zulus, you're not going to be happy.
Yeah. And that's something you have to know. You know, at least if you're not using the editor or anything, you have no control over. And that's something that I think a lot of people experience as a truth in the world. You know?
Just that they kind of start.
Yes.
Well, unfairness.
Yeah, unfairness, unequality of starting positions.
Well, you can see why they did that, because one game is completely different. When you play, like, just because it's more entertaining, you don't want to feel the same way each time.
So interestingly, Alpha Centauri, which was sort of Civ 2.5, had as one of its options to start on a fixed map with a fixed set of starting locations. You didn't know which of the starting locations you were going to have, but those starting locations were all fairly carefully balanced. So if you started on a map of the planet, you knew that you are in a decent, reasonably equal starting location with the Civ reasonably spread out.
Yes.
Or you do the more common thing and start on a random map where you'd be toast if you're on an island.
So they realize it doesn't, you know, but they didn't make that the default.
Yeah, that was very clearly an odd side option.
So it's something that they. And I think once they realized what a big effect it was having by that late in the series, they're like, that some people might not like that effect, but on the whole, we do. And we think our players do.
I want to say one thing about this.
Sure.
So one of the things that are really intrinsic to the game, which you don't see simply reading the text and you have to play it a lot, is that they tried very hard to make it possible to play the game without using those weapons. But you can't do it because it's always going to be easier to use military force or use your force. Because just one example, if you decide I'm going to stay very defensive, I'm going to invest everything in culture and so on, you still will have to invest in your defenses. And if you invest in your defenses and you don't use them for offense, you basically waste your money.
What kind of victory are you running for, though? There's seven different victories in Civ. You can do technological, cultural,
right, but still,
you don't have to conquer.
But you still have to spend.
You don't have to, but many of them, once you've built enough armies to defend your cities against whoever's the most advanced rival,
you might as well.
That one, you might as well squash the wind.
Yeah,
you might as well. Because you're getting more culture by squashing the wind and taking the city.
If you spend all on troops and don't use them, it's a waste. So that kind of. It makes you use them.
And you still need to use them. And you're trying to go cultural, you're going to make your borders so you have to be defensive.
Right, but that's why I said you need to invest a certain amount of resources in
having
a military force. And the difference between the amount of military force you need to not be a really juicy target and the amount of military force you need to go is so little that at that point you're like, well, I'm 90% of the way there. Turn out another three tanks and, you know, eat it.
Well, I feel should, I mean, potentially, but we should encourage this conflict because the minute, like, you start, you call the board, they want to start, they're like, they'll start worse than you. You take one to the, and they're falling back, and you just start, like, want to clean up this conflict.
But on the other hand, on that giving a domination victory where you conquer all the other cities and rather it's like on the one hand it focuses way more it's again the conflict is unavoidable that you're if you start appeasing people then you get constantly bullied because they think we're gonna attack you, give us some culture or give us some gold or give us some tech or give us some gold. Or you can say, no, let's fight. If you start appeasing them, you
you start crushing them, they know they'll never be rid of the Danes.
Yeah,
exactly. That's historical.
Yeah.
I mean, every society has had wars for history. It's awesome. So,
not constantly, but
regularly.
But not constantly, and Finn certainly seems to be trying to teach you the lesson that it's not really possible for two cities next to each other to be friends in the long run. People seem to usually, especially at the harder levels, pretty aggressive, and just bumping borders with them will eventually. U.S. and Canada can never live together. We have a long common border.
They call ham bacon.
Yeah.
But we have a system, with the qualifier that, gameplay and fun always trumps moral or ethical message in the mainstream at least. So maybe it was just combat is more fun,
Than just building
not.
Like
the common strategy, like revolution, keep putting commoners in play and the backstory and something. You just constantly work the game. Like, you're not worried about your outward appearance.
While the explicit ideology is interesting, and I like talking about it, part of why I wanted to have this session was to talk a bit more about the implicit ideology, the things that your game is saying that you don't necessarily realize it's saying. Civ spends a lot of time on trying to model a realistic political situation in the world, and yet the player stays in power over a 6,000-year span.
And even in democracy, there's one person who decides that.
Yeah.
Because you're not the government, you're the Illuminati.
You guys know that game, Medieval Total War? They actually have a mechanic where if loyalty for your generals or something is too low, then your entire empire will just split in one turn, and half of it will go to the rebels. Which is a situation where you have to fight to stay in power and maintain loyalty, marry off the princess with the right general and stuff So there are games that try to do that. The thing is, I was playing Medieval and that happened. And half my empire just fucking vanished, or just needed went to war with the other half. And I was like, you know what? I don't like playing this, so I just stopped playing this.
It would get really boring if you were in Mark student that voted out power for 4 years. So it's try again in 4 turns. Well, one may I run your empire. The game plays itself until the AI is really stupid to get overthrown, and then you get another chance. That would be kind of awesome, right?
It would be not revolutionary.
That would be played that one with a couple mods.
Yeah, true. And there's another game that I think the Total War people were looking at, an older game from Microprose, Samurai, or possibly Sword Assist Samurai, that was, it was sort of along the line of Pirates, and there were lots of little mini-games, but the overarching theme of it was you're a minor Japanese noble trying to become Shogun and take over all of Japan. And that's a game that did embrace aging as a game mechanic. As time went on, your wisdom stat would go up, but eventually, no matter how good you were at the minigame, your sword fighting stat would start to drop. And you could, make alliances and, marry the daughter of a neighboring noble and get an heir. It was, in that game, it was really hard to conquer Japan starting from scratch. And so a typical thing that would happen partway along would be you'd say, okay, I'm going to retire and leave my lands to my heir. Some of which would revolt, but not half.
So you can play your heir from that point on?
Yes. And his stats are generally a little worse than hers to start with. You got to, you know, sort of, but it's not from the standing start. You know, you're not going back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, typically around the second or third generation, if you're doing well.
The other thing, like, with Sith and the whole, like, conquering is the best strategy in a lot of cases, things like group push conquering, is that when we're playing these games, you got to remember that you're not you. You're like a autistic sociopath. Like, and that's what you would do if you were not a sociopath with absolute control over a country. Yeah, and that's a lifespan. That's what you would do. So, yeah, like, if all you want to do was, like, win some sort of psychopathic game in your head, where you have to control the world, otherwise you're not satisfied, then those are reasonable strategies. The thing is, like, if you're playing as a human being, if you sort of, it's realistic, it's just you're not realistic. No leader has those kinds of, most of them, hopefully. Don't like, completely disconnected from humanity in that kind of way.
No one just goes, fuck you, and bombs are sitting out of war.
Yeah, like, I'm playing Div, and I'm like, you know, I'm out of war, and I'm going to nuke this continent, see how many people I can kill, you know, just, like, for fun.
In Saratoga, it's all one turn to get present, but I think there's still a point that you can go, like, you know, clearly there's a lack of realism here. There's still some sort of, not even necessarily entire ethics, but sort of implied statements about how the world works. Like, just about every first-person shooter ever has taught me that one guy who is super badass can take out an entire fucking army using their fortifier, which is clearly not true. And by clearly, I mean I'm basing this off of all of my experience in the United States Army, which is still but, you know, I feel like those games have taught me that is, you know, an acceptable thing to believe.
I think that just goes back to what Ben was saying, where, like, mechanics, like, fun trumps realism, fun trumps ideology, where it's like, well, what was the, there's some game where, like, you take super, oh, the first Rainbow Six was extraordinarily frustrating to me, where it's like, oh, I got shot in the leg, and I'm done. Like, I'm done, and it's like, that is, you know, if I got shot in the leg, I probably would be done,
yeah.
But it's not fun, like, and they fix that for future Rainbow Six games. I think that's part of that has to do. That specifically in the first person shooter.
Yeah, your average soldier, more or less by definition, only ever shoots about one enemy soldier, because really, only two evaporate.
Much less than that, because usually one kill.
Yeah, most soldiers retire.
Most kills are from artillery and like heavy weapons, so very rarely does anybody actually shoot.
Yeah, but if you had a I am a soldier randomly to go fight in a battle game where in most games you don't kill anyone, that'd probably be a fairly boring game.
Or more likely, realistically, you just sort of fire at the enemy position
and you have no clue whether you actually even shot anybody. You're like, yeah, I put 75 bullets into the front of that bunker and all of a sudden this is one who killed somebody.
Alternatively, one of your soldiers breaks formation, runs into the enemy bunker, tosses his three grenades, and then walks in and picks up all their ammunition.
I'm wondering about this implicit thing. I'm trying to think of other examples of games that are like teaching us something through the experience.
What about GTA?
Well, GTA, I don't know.
So most MMOs, for example, have an implicit killing is the way to achieve every goal, because really that's your one gameplay mechanic.
Most games, not even MMOs.
What is the game that you played together with, like, it was like what I learned from it was Kleptomania, Pyromania, and
something.
Oh, yeah. You pick up everything that's not nailed down.
Even that, you still have to set some place on fire.
Yeah.
And, but this was a game that in most respects was like very
cheap,
you know, it had a smart female protagonist.
A longest journey.
Oh.
But baked into the genre mechanics are pick up everything in the world that's not nailed down. If you can pry it up, it's not nailed down.
Including things written for people. I've been shocked by the number of RPGs where you walk into somebody's house, they're sitting there ready to talk to you, and the first thing you do is go check behind the bed to see if there's a chest there.
That's what I love about Monkey Island. You just have little puzzles in Monkey Island, or you're going to pick something up and someone goes, what are you doing? Don't do that. You have to find a way to get them out of there.
I think that's so absurd, it doesn't really express my ideology, though. Yeah. Nobody thinks that. I mean, it's just so far out there.
There is actually, speaking of Monkey Island, one of the things I did take it around to mention was the concepts of reward and failure that I touched on briefly earlier. The early adventure games, the Infocoms and the Sierras, they actually, to a certain extent, a large amount of the fun of the gameplay was expressed through failure. It's like, if you do the wrong thing, you will die horribly, but amusingly. And the first Monkey Island game actually was a radical change in perspective on the way to make these games, in that they denied the possibility of failure. That was the first adventure game which it was not possible to get into an unwinnable state.
You got it once. You got one from the three Monkey Island where you just get underwater.
No, yeah. If you work really, really
hard.
But there's another puzzle in there where you might think you can render the game unwinnable because instead of using the catapult to hit the banana tree, you accidentally use it to sink the pirate ship that was how you got to the island and how you're going to get off now. And if you do that, and you don't restore from the save game, you find this really fun alternate ending about how there's another boat, and you didn't lose.
There's a difference between losing and locking yourself into an unwinnable state.
Yeah, the
ladder myself.
They eliminated the sort of the notional category of loser. You can't be a loser playing this game. I mean, you're sort of playing, in an emotional sense, a lovable loser. But you will win in the end. You can be temporarily stymied. You can have not have thought of the solution yet. But you can have lost.
You can be a perpetual non-winner.
Yes.
If you stop playing the game.
Oh, yeah. The MMOs are sort of the ultimate expression of that.
We will be building game in front of you for volunteer students to get in play.
Yep.
Keep giving your money out. Keep playing the show.
Another game, just sort of switching topics a little bit, that I thought was interesting was Sims, at least the Sims 2 and maybe the Sims 1, which is the interesting thing about it is that all the Sims are bisexual, basically all the time. So. I mean, I'm not sure how they might have handled that differently, but just in terms of sort of the message I might send to you,
That was a very explicit decision on their part to make the game mechanic.
But they don't, talk about it at all. It's just sort of the silent thing, which is
Yes. And that's actually part of what I'm getting at here, is that these things are more powerful because they're silent.
Yeah.
Because they can't be argued against, or at least it doesn't occur to most people to argue against them.
Are you implying that Deus Ex might have been less crazy if it didn't hit in the face of the frying pan of political philosophy?
I think it could have been more successful if it didn't use a frying pan. This is hard because, as has already been mentioned several times, the fun trumps. And to a certain extent, genre expectations trump. Working on Bioshock, we have this sort of complex moral dilemma thing that we want to express. But really, this is a game about running around and shooting people in the head.
I would argue that there is a moral dilemma in Bioshock. Because there's a clear yes, this is the way to do it.
There's a clear correct answer.
Yeah, exactly. And since it's in the context of a game,
like, so it's in the context of a game, like, players are playing to win, and to win you go for the one that's more advantageous. And, like, in Bioshock, like, even if you hate Little Sisters, it's so clearly advantageous to stay at home. So, like,
we certainly have a lot of those changes. Now, we were only very vaguely successful. I don't claim this is a good example, just relevant to me. But, you know, first we tried to make it a little hidden about whether this is really a good and evil choice, and that failed for most people. And then we tried to hide about is the short-term benefit or the long-term benefit really better.
Did you just say that you tried to hide whether or not shooting a leaf or what's in their head?
I remember the icons used to be an angel or a devil that you would choose.
All right, you were good. Yeah, once you know what the long-term reward typically tends to be, then it becomes clear that the long-term reward is significantly superior. And I think that was, to some extent, a failure on our part.
So what does it say about this whole implicit thing where in Bioshock specifically, like, is it two Little Sisters? Once you kill two, if you save all the rest, you still get the, like, bad ending. What do you think that says, if anything?
Well, I was in that discussion when that was settled. It went back and forth a number of times. What proportion of being mean versus being good gets you which ending? And at the end of the day, Ken Levine said, I think, and it was his thought, I think most players are going to try it once to see what happens, and that's reasonable. But anyone who does it more than once after having seen what happens, they're a bastard and they should. Yeah, but they deserve. And there's also, to some extent, the fact that we went with exactly two endings, which was perhaps not the best choice. There was one major failing in the moral story structure of the game, is that you don't get a chance to repent at the sort of two-thirds mark when you find out more about what's going on. If you've been evil, you're stuck in evil.
That's what really tripped me up, actually, because like my character, I imagine my character going through this whole progression. Like at first he's like, oh, I should kill them, but then he has like a change of heart. And then the end of the game is kind of like, oh, it's just
always hard to do.
Evil, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, that you flip the evil switch at the beginning of the game.
Well,
okay.
I'm reminded of Knights of the Old Republic, though. Because towards the end of Knights of the Old Republic, they very clearly go, all right, I know I've been acting the whole game, how do you want to play it now? And they allow you to swing pretty heavily in either direction. I don't know how many of you have played
in that field,
but
it's sort of terrible. There's a bigger moment where you now decide the dark side of the light side for the final act, and you're clearly making your decision now, and maybe it's because I'm a game designer, but it seemed really beat you over the head with, this is the point of no return.
Yeah. That's because some people are going to say, I want to see both endings, but I only want to play the game once. So tell me where I should save the game. Before making the irrevocable choice.
Yeah, they do that.
They put in the amount of content to make it
worth playing cards. That's a similar problem where they try to offer all this, like, this ambiguity, like, you can behave however you want, and that'll mean maybe you're good, maybe you're evil. And then they have, like, a good and evil stat. It's like, you have 22 evil points. Where is the ambiguity? And like, since there aren't any games that I can think of off the top of my head that like sort of just let you define your own ethics, like is that what game designers do?
It's like that.
Game has two,
The thing that lets you define the good and evil is open it, like, your own narrative.
Because technically they allow you to make moral choices, and
and they actually are affected by their wrong choices. The reason I can't stand them is because I was told my data sex, and the fact that you're not actually making the wrong choices in data sex, you're just being basically reprimanded by people or praised by people for the various actions you take at least within the game. So you're not really making a moral choice to throw a bunch of terrorists. But if you do, either Anna Navarro is going to be upset or your brother's going to be upset. And it's just a question of being more upset more. And I thought that was freaking awesome because it's based entirely off your action and not what you say. In fact, your character's dialogue completely changes based off of what you're actually doing and not what you're actually saying, which I like a lot.
Yeah, I like that there are many sections where your character just spontaneously justifies whatever it was.
Exactly. And one of the things I love about Deus Ex is that, like, you know, you listen to it and it's like, J.G. Benson has this kind of monotone voice, but I realize why they did that halfway through, because some of the things that he says can be taken either way only if he's talking in a monotone voice. So it's just a kind of a way to be able to branch that very, very easily. And that's kind of the thing that, in, you know, in Fable, and I assume in Fable 2, you can do all these unethical things that affect how people view you in the game, but not the major characters. They're going to react to you the exact same way they would react to you, for the most part, so because they're major blockers.
So do you not do KOTOR in that? Because I feel like KOTOR gives you plenty of chances to actually do things.
Mostly through, but it's mostly through dialogue trees, and it's horribly obvious which one's doing which one's doing.
That's true. There's not something to
be. Yes. But the one thing that I really wanted, the other one, because we ended up talking about engineering and talking about ethics, is one game that I actually don't think many people have played, which is an extremely dark game, which is Coaster Boys or Shadow of Darkness. Well, the series is not generally very dark. The Coaster Boys was extremely dark. It's based off of Russian mythology. And there's several points in that game where you're doing the best thing for the entire area, but what you're doing is you can consider morally reprehensible. The two areas specifically are, in order to get the staff that you need to have to win the game, you have to perform a ritual where a living creature has to willingly sacrifice his life for someone who's dead. And you end up convincing this little girl with her only friend in the world, this big, hulking, like, ugly beast, to perform this ritual of release. And you think that the little girl understands what's going on until you start performing the ritual. And she basically, like, screamed out in terror when it happened. And you're just like, you feel so bad, because in order to actually do that, you have to spend time with her and understand, like, her whole character and why she ran away with this beast that became a vampire. So when that happens, you feel horrible about taking away from this little girl, the only friend she's ever had in the world. But it's the right thing to do, because it puts her back, it brings her back to life, puts her back with her parents where she belongs, and helps you actually stop the evilness that comes into the world. And it's just one of those things that's kind of like ambiguous, where it's like, they did the right thing, but wasn't really the right, like, I feel really bad about it. And then the other one is, if you're playing as a paladin and only as a paladin, there is, in Russian mythology, there's Rozloka, which is a girl who has been killed by being drowned, and then pulls other men into the waters to drown with her. And you're given a spell to reduce her from her bonds, but when the last thing you have to do in order to release her is go back to her and, like, show her love. But when you go back to her, she's like halfway between living, like being in the land of the living and being in the land of the dead, and she's horribly frightened, and she doesn't know what to do, and she doesn't want to die. And it's another one of those things where, like, did I actually help her? Like, she doesn't want this to be happening. So it's just one of, like, those are places where I don't see happen much of things, where there's an enormously ambiguous choice that you have to make.
Well, and that's also like it's letting the player sort of decide. It's giving the player lots of emotionally charged and diverse situations, and that's sort of letting you decide for yourself whether you thought that was ultimately good or evil. And the game is actually not coming down and saying, wow, you're 25% evil and 75% good. And it's like,
that's not a good reason. It's kind of what has to, at least in Coaster Boys, what has to be done.
What I think is interesting about these more linear games is that, like, the way these games give out ambiguity is by presenting players with like this illusion of choice, and then going, how do you feel about it? Like, by not giving you like a bunch of different choices, but by going, you know, we kind of can take to you a bunch of choices. We can only do this one because we're just a game. Like, but how do you feel? Like, GTA is one where they, so they give a, I haven't played that much of it, but they go to great lengths to paint. Mika is like this victim of circumstance. Yeah. Like, no matter what you do, you end up as a hitman for the mob, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the story. Yeah, because that's the story of this like multi-billion-dollar game.
You can not progress the story, but if you progress the story, you're a hitman for the mob.
Yeah.
So you kill hundreds of people.
Yeah. It's just a matter of, do you feel bad or are you enjoying it?
I think most of you would have been in Torment before. That's a Torment. So I got all over the place. It's like,
oh, yeah. You know. The driving force of their game design, I thought was brilliant.
So something that I like a lot about Torment is that it is not immediately obvious all the time which dialogue choices result in what kind of alignment change. And so eventually you just kind of look at your alignment and you go, crap, I'm chaotic evil now? I thought I was playing an RPG.
Yeah, but the game actually doesn't. It's kind of interesting. The game actually doesn't really punish. It does punish you for preventing from finishing the game. It doesn't really punish you. For
yeah, there are certain people that will only hang out with you if you have a particular alignment, or at the very least, you swear to be a particular alignment.
Because you can lie.
Yeah.
Which will, of course, make you more chaotic.
But there are people on each end of the scale, right? So
right.
In either case, you're missing somebody.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's not like, you know, being evil is bad or horrible. You know, screw about finishing the game.
Did you guys play, who here is familiar with the earlier Ultimate games? Like, because in my...
I don't know.
But that's an interesting thing.
It's technically earlier.
But like, 4 through 6 have karma, right? Where you actually, your decisions get sort of rewarded, you know, like whether you're humble or, you know, you need all these virtues. Then 7... Four especially, but it's still in 6. But then 7, they took that out, so you don't have the karma set anymore, and you don't get punished.
They still have virtues, though.
Yeah, but you don't actually get punished for breaking them at in 7, which some people complain about, but it's interesting, so it expands like that, you know, both ways on that. Some people were like, oh, but now I'm not punished, so the morality doesn't mean anything, and some people were like, well, yeah, but it's like they're saying you're an adult now, so...
Not how morality works.
You know, now there's no God who's going to punish you for doing bad things. You just feel like you're dirty. So, but I don't know. It would be interesting that they took it out.
I feel like that's kind of one of the five underpinnings that almost every RPG I've ever played. Doing the good thing almost inevitably results in more reward.
Yeah.
Like almost every game I've ever played, if you go, no, I don't need that reward. They go, oh, well, let me give you $1 million or something. And I'm like, oh. And occasionally I'll play a game and I'll be like, no, I don't need that reward. And they won't give me $1 million, but I'll get 8 lifetime points or something.
Yeah.
Which is cool that aren't like that. I mean, that's like Mass Effect, and you can only sleep with the consort Blue Girl if you're an asshole to her.
Yeah, but that's the exception.
And he's
talking about where occasionally it's just like, all right, and now in order to kill the village, you're going to have to grab an innocent child and shove a knife through their heart, and that's the only way you can save the village. Like, that never happens in most times.
You know what's interesting about it? You mentioned Mass Effect going back to The Sims and bisexuality. Like, that's a weird...
Yep. Quick interruption. We are over time, so we're into the break.
It's fine. You can run into the break.
I thought I'd let you know that was happening.
I think it's an interesting moral for you can only be bisexual as a woman. You can't be bisexual as a man.
Well,
no, because there's two characters you can have sex with in Mass Effect, aren't there?
Actually, the consort, Caden, or is that it?
Yeah. And if you're a male, you can only have sex with the female in the consort, and if you're the female, you can have sex with the male in the consort, and like,
yeah.
So. I'm saying that doesn't make the woman not bisexual.
But if you're a female, you can have sex with Ashley, right?
No.
The consort is not female.
That's almost
now we're getting into an argument.
Sexuality is way more interesting.
She's like looks like a woman and has womanly curves, but she's got a dick. Like, that's not how that works.
She's like,
yeah,
that's how it works.
that's a bad thing that I ever played.
To me, that somebody reflects like the current sort of ideology we have in our culture, it's sort of like it's okay to be a gay, it's much more okay to be a gay.
Which is funny because traditionally male is the neutral term.
I guess I'm thinking of the Bechdel test. Do you guys know the Bechdel test?
No.
So the Bechdel test is this awesome thing that applies.